ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
That was Role Model with Sally, When the Wine Runs Out. What a thought. Although the wine and the champagne never seems to run out at this time of year, as the Christmas parties and other end-of-year celebrations start to roll around. And do you roll around as well at those celebrations? Is it a little difficult to keep track of the alcohol intake? You might fall into the category of a grey area drinker. That means you might not be sure if you actually do have a problem with alcohol. You might not meet the criteria for what we generally consider to be an alcoholic. Look, I was recently getting that feeling. So I put the brakes on and I found a book that really, really helped me understand what was going on and made me feel like I wasn't alone. It's called The Sober Diaries. It was so helpful that I thought I'd like to talk to the person who wrote it, and that is Claire Pooley. She's a New York Times bestselling author with three novels, including her most recent book, How to Age Disgracefully. I think a few of us nightlifers can jump into that category. But she says none of her writing would have been possible if she hadn't given up drinking a decade ago. So she put this book together, and as we head into the festive season and the alcohol is going strong and the temptation to drink might be even stronger, I thought it was a great time to have Claire on. Claire Pooley, welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, thank you. It's so great to be here.
Are you looking forward to a sober, silly season?
Oh, you know what? I'm always grateful at Christmas and New Year that I don't drink, which I never would have believed that I would ever say, because, you know, drinking was such a big part of my life. I couldn't possibly have imagined 10 years ago that I could go to a party and not drink, let alone do the whole of Christmas and New Year without alcohol. But, you know, now I just remember those days, and I remember how stressful they were and how difficult it is getting through that whole time when you're constantly hungover or drunk. And, you know, I was anxious all the time. I wasn't sleeping properly. I was quite a lot overweight because of all the calories. And, you know, I'd wake up in the morning and have to look at my phone and check that I hadn't sent somebody an embarrassing text late at night and try and work out where my handbag was and all those really stressful things I don't have to deal with anymore. So, no, I'm looking forward to it.
All those stressful things that you don't realise are slowly, slowly creeping up on you. Can you give us an idea of sort of how it gets to that point and how you sort of don't really notice until it's at crisis level?
Yeah, I mean, it is so gradual. I mean, I started work in advertising in the 90s, and it was like in the days of Sex and the City and Absolutely Fabulous and Bridget Jones. And, you know, I thought that all young emancipated feminists drank as much as the guys did. And, you know, gradually over the years, my alcohol intake didn't decrease. It just gradually got more and more and more because my tolerance increased. So, you know, I wasn't one of those people that was constantly looked drunk. Nobody staged an intervention or anything like that. It was just the fact that I got to the point where I could drink a bottle of wine without even noticing it. You know, towards the end of the day, when I was trying to unwind and relax, I'd open a bottle of wine and I'd drink a large glass, and then I'd drink another, and then I'd drink a third, and my glasses were really large. And so three glasses was effectively the whole bottle. And I would do that every night, apart from on Saturdays and Sundays, when I would probably drink two bottles in the course of the day. So I was drinking 10 bottles of wine a week. And nobody really paid attention, least of all me. I kind of thought everyone else was doing it. And then, you know, gradually I started realizing what an impact it was having.
And I think you make a really good point there with wine in particular, becoming so normalized with women, Gen X, millennials, you know, the wine mum culture. It's like sort of a funny little joke, you know, it's a meme. It's like, yes, oh, I've got to have a drink to get through it all, motherhood and work, being a working woman and all that kind of stuff. Did you realise that is a thing as well? Did you sort of notice it more when you gave up?
Yeah, I mean, I loved all of that at the time, you know, the wine o'clock thing. And
well, it legitimizes it, right? Like, yeah, it makes it fine. It's okay. We're all doing it, you know.
Yeah, Exactly. And, you know, you go on a play date with the kids and, you know, you'd be just as likely to be offered a glass of wine as you were a cup of tea. And, you know, I honestly thought that everyone was drinking the same way as me. I mean, maybe they were all drinking the same way as me. And yeah, it's only when you stop drinking that you realize how ingrained it is in everyday, you know, everyday culture. You can't really get away from it. And yeah, I think it's really dangerous because actually drinking that much makes motherhood really hard. You know, I would get to the end of the day and, you know, those precious moments when you're reading a bedtime story to your kids. And I would race through the story as fast as I could so that I could get to the fridge and open a bottle of wine. And I felt like I was constantly running away from my own children and missing so much of their childhood because I wasn't really present. My mind wasn't there. My mind was on when I was going to be able to get some me time, if you like. So, yeah, so I think it's quite pervasive and it can be quite dangerous, I think, over time.
Yeah, and you sort of just, again, it's all normal. You don't realize that it is affecting the way you can function. And look, I'm saying this as someone who, you know, read your book when I really needed to, and what a difference it made to hear everything sort of reflected back to me. And it was very much a companion, very helpful companion to just cutting out booze as a you know, mummy drinker. Your decision to start blogging about it under a sort of a pseudonym, like you were hiding, there was a secret blog. Why did you hide who you were initially? What was behind that decision?
You know what? When I first quit drinking, and this was in 2015, and I think things have changed a bit since then. Certainly amongst younger people, it has. Maybe not so much amongst the Gen Xs. You know, back then I felt like I was the only person that had got into this sort of situation. I felt really alone and I felt really ashamed. And I really didn't feel like I could talk to anyone about it. I was too scared to go to AA. I didn't want to talk to my GP because I thought they'd judge me. And, you know, I was worried they'd tell social services or something. I was too worried about telling my husband or my friends or anyone. But I sort of knew I had to get it all off my chest. And so I thought initially, well, I'll write a diary. But that felt quite old fashioned. I thought everyone's doing blogs these days. So I started writing this anonymous blog just as therapy, really. And I called it Mummy Was a Secret Drinker. And I called myself Sober Mummy. And I really didn't want anyone to know it was me because, yeah, as I said, I was just too ashamed about the whole thing. But that blog really saved my life. I didn't publicize it at all, but it went completely viral. And within a year, I'd had over 1 million hits from women all over the world, and some men actually, who were sort of in exactly the same position as me. And we became a little community who really helped each other. And yeah, it was an amazing thing. And that became the book, The Sober Diaries.
And we are speaking with Claire Pawley, author of The Sober Diaries. You're listening to Nightlife with Greta Lee Jackson. Claire, there's some of the analogies you use, which come from your research during your, you know, becoming sober and documenting it. They're really, really brilliant. I want to talk about the wall, climbing over the wall, and if people feel like they, you know, oh, I'll just have that one. If they've quit for a little while and then they start up again, it's actually a bigger problem than you realize.
I mean, I was one of those people who constantly quit for a little bit. So, you know, I do dry January and I do sober October and, you know, or at least I do a bit of them. You know, I get to about 3 weeks and then cave usually. And I do sort of, you know, I would give myself all sorts of rules, like, you know, I'm only going to drink 3 days a week, or I'm only going to drink when I'm out, or I'm going to alternate drinks with water. I mean, I tried everything.
Yeah, I've done that. All those.
And, you know, eventually once I managed to quit for about 100 days, which is about as long as it takes to start feeling, you know, what I now think of as normal again, I realized that I was just making my life so much harder by just doing, a few weeks sober and then going back to the beginning. So I wrote this blog post called The Obstacle Course, and I talked about how, when you keep going back to the beginning, you're doing the hardest bit of getting sober over and over again. So it's like you're doing this obstacle course, and instead of getting all the way to the end, you're just doing the first few obstacles and then going back to the start and then doing those obstacles again and going back to the start. And I talked about how I imagined myself in this world where everything was getting really dark and horrible and thundery and nasty, and there I was, and try and to get I'd heard about this beautiful land somewhere else where there were lots of bunnies and rainbows and flowers, and I knew that to get there I just had to get through this obstacle course. And I talked about how I was constantly going back to the beginning, and all you had to do is get to the end of the obstacle course and you'd be in the field of bunnies, and then you'd never have to do the obstacle course again. And even now, all these years later, I get people sending me little emojis of bunnies and rainbows saying, "I got to the bunny field."
And the other, I mean, that goes straight into the other analogy that you used that I want to talk about, which is the pink cloud. That when you have that moment of, oh, wow, okay, this is what it feels like to be alcohol free.
Yeah, I mean that's an AA expression, the pink cloud that I came
Well, see, there
across.
you go. I haven't been to AA either, so but
No,
that's right.
I haven't been to AA either, but I've talked to a lot of people who have, and the pink cloud is how people often describe the first few weeks of getting sober, when, because of the way your brain chemistry works, initially your mind sort of pings into this sort of, world where, not for everybody, but for me certainly, everything seemed really, beautiful, and it was filled with possibility, and I thought this is going to be great. And then you hit, often a few weeks in, something that, again, people describe of as the wall, where, it's suddenly really hard again, and a lot of people fall off the wagon at that point because they think, "Oh God, I just thought things were getting better, and now I'm at this point where everything's got worse." And that's kind of why I wanted to publish the book, because when I first got sober, I read everything I could about quitting drinking, and all these sort of, all these memoirs and biographies and how-to books, everything. And generally, with people's stories, they would talk about what life was like when they were drinking, and then they would get to the end and they'd say, "And then I got sober, and then everything was fine." And I think, "Hold on, hold on. I need more information. I need to know how you got sober, how long it took to feel fine, what stages you went through, what to look out for, any hints and tips." And I couldn't find that. And so I wanted to write, effectively the story of my first year sober to give people a bit, sort of like a roadmap of what it might be like.
And Claire, I touched on it before, the term grey area drinker. So, when we think of alcohol use, your mind immediately goes to, alcoholic, like the complete and utter dependency. But how is a grey area drinker different?
Well, that's a relatively recent phrase, actually, because
Yeah,
when
because
I
it wasn't
drinking,
around when in 2015 when you were questioning it yourself, yeah.
and I think it's partly because of people like me that that phrase now exists. Because, when I first quit, it was generally people figured that you were either a normal drinker or you were an alcoholic, and that was it. And I spent so much time trying to work out if I was an alcoholic, and I really wanted the answer to be no, because I really didn't want to quit drinking. So, I do all those little Google searches in the middle of the night. Am I an alcoholic? And it give you this sort of questionnaire that you had to fill in, and like, do you drink in the morning, and do you have blackouts, and that sort of thing. And at the end, it would say, "You may or may not have a problem with alcohol." And I think, "Oh, I know, I knew that
Again, you
already.
need more info.
From the
Yeah.
answer." And there's along with that, there was this idea that in order to be able to quit drinking, you had to hit rock bottom. You had to get to that stereotypical chronic alcoholic situation where you were sleeping on park benches and drinking methylated spirits. And only at that point was it possible to give up, which is absolute nonsense. I mean, for a start, now there's this understanding that, there is very much a spectrum from normal drinker to alcoholic. And a grey area drinker is really somebody who is having problems with alcohol and really would feel much better if they got it out of their lives, but without falling into, that extreme end of the spectrum. And, there is absolutely no reason to wait until you hit rock bottom. That's a really, really dangerous thing to do because nobody wants to get there. Nobody wants to completely mess up their lives and their relationships and their work and everything else. It's far better to get off that slippery slide while you're still a grey area drinker before things, start causing you real problems.
And culturally, so, obviously you're from the UK, we're here in Australia. It's ubiquitous, it seems, grey area drinking. From your position, would you agree, just given how many people get in touch with you and express that your story just mirrors theirs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of us worldwide, and it's absolutely nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, alcohol is an addictive drug, and becoming addicted to it is not your fault. That's just the way it works. So, I think the great thing about this new awareness of the spectrum and the number of people who are questioning their relationship with alcohol is that, it's no longer as shameful as it was when I was in that situation. And, in fact, I did a TED talk, years ago called Making Sober Less Shameful, which was all about how we can change society's attitudes towards alcohol, because alcohol is still the only drug that you have to justify not taking. When you give up any other drug, people go, "Yay, well done!" And you give up alcohol, and they go, "Really? Did you have a problem?" It's like, "No, I didn't have a problem. Alcohol is a problem."
Yes. And you were Googling, talked about Googling, am I an alcoholic? And still not, not having the clear answers. What should you be asking instead?
Oh, good question. Because the question you really should be asking is alcohol making my life difficult? And would my life be better without it? And if I'd been asking that question, I would have given up a lot sooner. Because, that's what really matters. And, I just got to the point, actually, a few years before I eventually quit, where the upsides of drinking just weren't worth the downsides, and I think everybody is grappling with that scale. When you're in your teens, the upsides are great and the downsides are really minimal. You bounce out of bed the morning after a drinking session without any sort of major impact. But as you get older, the downsides get more and more obvious and the upsides are less and less obvious. So, I think you get to the point where you should be asking the question, is this improving my life or not? And then I think as well as that, there's a question about, is it possible for me to cut down? Because, if you can, if alcohol is causing a problem and you can drink more sensibly, then hooray. That's absolutely great. I'm really happy for you. I'm also a bit jealous. Because for me, it and for a lot of people, moderating an addictive drug is just not possible. And, I'm kind of the same with everything. I'm a bit all or nothing about cake, about crisps, about love and friendship and alcohol. I can't do things in half measures. So I tried and tried and tried to drink less and to drink sensibly, and I just couldn't do it. And it was so stressful, constantly, setting these rules I was breaking. And it just led me to hate myself. I ended up with such little self-respect because I just couldn't do it. And it took me a long time to realize that it was far, far, far easier for me to stop drinking altogether than to try and drink in a sensible way. And that was the best decision I ever made. But not everyone is like that, So I think you need to know yourself whether you are somebody who can do things moderately. And whether you can drink moderately. And if you can't, or you find it really difficult, or alcohol is constantly in your head, filling up all that space with sort of thoughts like, am I going to drink tonight? How much should I drink tonight? Have I got enough food, wine in the fridge? All of that sort of stuff. You are much better off without it at all, believe me. So those are the questions you should be asking.
And in the Sober Diaries, you outline that it's just not as simple as, oh, do I enjoy alcohol? It's figuring out why you drink and doing the work in order to do that, because a lot of us drink to cope, and, you know, to cope with really hard times. When those really hard times hit you and the prospect of, you know, getting drunk to cope was looming from the wine witch, you know, who we'll talk about in a moment. Look, how hard was that? You know, knowing that that's what you've always got to cope, how did you reconcile not turning to the bottle when things got really, really personally tough for you?
Yeah, I mean, you're so right. That is the difficult thing about quitting drinking. It's the fact that if you've been a big drinker for decades, like I had, you get really used to using alcohol to numb any difficult feelings. So the minute I was stressed or anxious or depressed or whatever, I would drink. Also, funny enough, if I was happy or celebrating.
Yeah, to celebrate. Yeah, it's both. Yeah.
I would reach for a glass of wine. And it takes quite a while to find other ways of dealing with that stress. But actually, interestingly, alcohol really doesn't help with stress and anxiety and worry at all. It helps temporarily, you know, so for an hour or two, it might make you feel a bit better. It might make you forget. But as soon as the alcohol wears off and you end up with that awful hangover, everything comes back tenfold. So when I quit, I had to find other ways of dealing with that stress. And 8 months after I quit, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, which, funny enough, is related to drinking a lot of alcohol. So I suppose it shouldn't have been a surprise, but it was a big surprise to me. And I had to go through that without drinking. And you know what? Even now, I look back and I think how glad I am that I wasn't drinking then, because if I had been, all the wheels would have fallen off. You know, I would have cracked up in front of the kids. I would have found it way too hard to deal with, and I would have been a complete mess. And I sort of needed to keep everything together for my whole family, not just for me. So being sober was really important. And the great thing is that all the tools that you discover when you quit drinking, so things like taking it one day at a time and finding distraction techniques and finding healthy ways of dealing with stress, you know, from doing yoga to having a hot bath to going out for a walk with an audiobook, you know, all the tools I had in my toolbox for dealing with those difficult times, I could then use when it came to dealing with breast cancer. So, you know, I do tell people that, you know, quitting alcohol may be really hard, but it will help you out for the rest of your life, because the things that you learn when you quit drinking, you can pull into play whenever you need them. And you will need them, because life deals us, you know, lemons from, you know, regular intervals. And you need to be there with a, you know, a machete and not a glass of gin and tonic.
It's almost like, you know, transforming that thought pattern of, oh, I have to drink to cope, to owing your ability to cope to not drinking eventually. Yeah. Getting there. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, if you manage to deal with things without drinking, you know that you have the ability to do it. You know that you are strong. Whereas if you're constantly drinking to deal with it, you don't know that. You just, all you know is that you know, alcohol numbs those feelings for a short period of time.
You're listening to Nightlife. I'm Greta Lee Jackson, and with me is Claire Pooley, who is the author of The Sober Diaries. Claire, we did mention earlier that, you know, we're about to head into, you know, silly season, Christmas time. Tips and tricks. I know that you're a big fan in your book of those Beck's Blues, those alcohol-free beers. They were helpful. And anything else that you at parties or events that you used to sort of get through those, rather than avoiding them entirely? Because I mean, that's unreasonable. I think it's all very isolating.
Yeah,
but
you didn't miss out on the parties at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, when I quit, the only alcohol-free beer available was Beck's Blue, which actually now I think tastes rather filthy. But, you know, back then it was all I had. And now there are, at least in the UK, there are so many different brands. There are alcohol-free beers, there are alcohol-free spirits and wines. And, you know, there's the supermarkets have a whole aisle of no and low alcohol options. But yeah, in terms of parties, I think having a good alcohol-free drink available is really important because you want to feel like you're joining in. You don't want to feel like you're different from everyone else. And you're standing there with a glass of water where everyone else is drinking cocktails. And, you know, another thing that I've realized over time is that, you know, you don't have to stay till the end. And in fact, the end of a party, nobody ever really remembers, you know.
Yeah, but when you're on the drink, you're always the last one, right?
Yeah. If you're at a big drinking party, you notice the last couple of hours, people are saying the same thing over and over again. You know, the next day they'll hardly remember that bit at all. They won't know if you leave at midnight. You know, so you know what I do is I go to a party, I enjoy the best of the party when everyone's on really good form, and then I do what they call, I think they call it a French exit, which is where you leave without saying goodbye. You just sneak out the back. Nobody knows you've gone because they're all too drunk to notice, and you wake up the next day feeling brilliant. And then also just remember the good things about it. I can drive to parties now and I can drive back. And that makes sense. You remember the days when you used to have to, you know, you'd be in the middle of nowhere and you had to try and find a minicab that would come out and collect you. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, you're putting it off because it was going to be such a drama, and it got later and later. And then it was 3 o'clock in the morning. You think, oh my God, how am I going to get home? Don't have to worry about any of that. Yeah, I mean, I love parties now, and I have great conversations with people that, you know, people I haven't seen for ages, and we talk about stuff that matters, and I remember it all, you know.
Yeah.
Which is not what I would have done in the old days.
I don't remember a lot from that time, but I do remember sitting on the phone for long stints of time, to taxis combined, you know, early in the morning. It's not like that. Again, that's another thing that's changed nowadays, but that I do remember. And what about your creativity? You say that you owe your success in writing to getting sober. How does that work? Can you take me through that?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I was in advertising for 20 years and, you know, but in my heart of hearts, I always wanted to be a novelist. You know, that was my big dream. But I never had the time. I never had the courage. I was too scared of rejection. You know, all sorts of reasons I didn't do it. And, you know, it was only when I quit drinking that I started writing again, initially as a form of therapy. And then it became my sort of new addiction, my new passion. And, you know, when you quit drinking, you create so much more time. You know, I realized how much time I spent either drunk or hungover or planning the next, you know, the next session or whatever it was. And so, you know, 2 years after I quit drinking and I published the Sober Diaries, and I thought, I want to carry on writing, but I don't want to carry on writing about my own life. I want to write fiction. And, you know, I think people think that alcohol helps creativity, but so many people tell me that when they quit drinking, their brain starts firing on all cylinders. So I started writing fiction, and my first novel was called The Authenticity Project, which was loosely based on my own experience of suddenly telling the own truth about the real truth about my life and the impact that had on the people around me. And then I went on to publish two more novels, The People on Platform 5 and How to Age Disgracefully, which is my latest. So yeah, and I think not only did I have more time and more creativity, but I was also, it was this courage that I was talking about before. You know, I was still scared of rejection, but at the same time, I thought, well, what's the worst that can happen? I've battled an addiction. I've got through cancer. I can deal with a few people saying, no, I don't like your writing. I'm not going to publish your novel. Hell, that's an easy one to get through.
Well, Claire, look, it's very, very enlightening speaking to you. Like I said, it was such a wonderful support to me to have the Sober Diaries with me. Just knowing that someone has gone through what I was going through, and not just yourself, your whole community that you built by putting your story out there. It's so worthwhile, and it's been a pleasure talking with you tonight.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.